There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, let's do the check thing. Mark, are you sitting comfortably, leaning forward and all that
stuff? I am. How does that sound?
Okay. All right, so...
How does that sound?
One. All right, Rob Zombie joins the podcast. That's what it sounded like, Rob Zombie. So, hey, everybody, welcome to episode 273 of the More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitchell, and I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jaime Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And we have Mark Rubens on the line from San Jose, California.
Hello.
What do they call that style of music where people just holler?
Yeah, I don't know what they call it, but yeah.
It has a name. Yeah. It has a name, yeah. I remember I was looking at Twitter once, and they were like, oh, this singer is so hot, she's so good-looking, whatever, and I'm like, okay, really? And I'm like, oh, I better go check her out. And so I go over to, you know, YouTube and load up the video, and it's like, you know, she's like one of these... Very attractive.
Not my favorite style of music.
No, no. I mean, I get, you know, Carol calls like people like Aerosmith hollerers, right? But she has no idea.
Right. Yeah. It's it gets much worse. It gets much worse.
Yes,
much
worse. Worse. Everything in extremes.
Yeah.
All right. Did we just dig into this show here? Let's do it. All right. So starting off from last week's episode, we have one piece of fact check, and it was the word I could not remember in Xcode, and it was killing me. The word is toolchain. Let's try to remember how, you know, like if say, Swift 5.2 came out, you could download the toolchain, stick it into your Xcode, and try it out in your current version of Xcode, right? So that's, is that what you were thinking, Mark, last week when I was trying to stumble across this particular thing?
I think so. I forget exactly what the context was, but that sounds about right.
Yeah, we were talking about Xcode, and I think Carmi was off, you know, with his dealing with this delivery.
We were also talking about how you could select which version of the developer tools you wanted to use.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, and how I found it was I remembered that swift.org is where you would go to find newer releases of, or you'd find information on what's going on with Swift and that kind of stuff beyond, you know, in advance of what Apple's doing. You could look at, you know, documentation and stuff like that. You could see the changes and stuff like that that people have been putting through, you know, pull requests and all that kind of stuff. And, So I went over to the swift.org page to the downloads, and you can see, you know, Xcode 11.0 toolchain with debug symbols is, oh, it's unavailable. How about that? Yeah, why would that be unavailable? Anyway, so you can see, you know, Swift 4, 5, 3, 2, and you could, you know, grab those toolchains and stick them in. So when Swift.2 gets close to public release or beta release or whatever, even before Apple adds it into Xcode, you can add it to your current version of Xcode and try it out. And like we always like to say on the show, your mileage may vary. So there we go. Right, so Jaime, do you have some Ask MTJC?
We have a few. One that was from Halloween night, the day we actually recorded, but came out, or at least to my attention, after the recording, is by Jesse Cruikshank, who apparently has her kids dressed up as AirPods. One is the left, one is the right. You can kind of imagine what that might look like, but we'll have the link in the show notes for those of you driving at home.
So just as a real-time follow, we were just talking about how Twitter won't load in Safari for me. Guess what won't load in Safari?
You know, there's always Chrome.
Yeah, there's always Chrome. Anyway, yeah, it's just true. And there's a new browser coming. We'll talk about that later. But just so you know, Jesse Cruikshank is a Canadian television personality here in Toronto.
I had a feeling she was familiar to me. I was like, I feel like I know that name.
Well, we used to have an MTV, Canada MTV channel here, and she was one of the hosts. And now I think she works over at the sort of conglomerate, you know, Rogers Network or Bell or somebody like that. So I'm not sure what shows she's on, but yeah, she was one of the, I guess you call them VJs, on our Canadian version of MTV, which was around for a bit before it gets assumed into something
else. Well, those AirPods would definitely fall out of my ears.
Yeah.
I think these kids are slightly, like, you really should go check out the photos if you're listening to this. The kids don't really look that happy, and I feel like they're slightly too old to be dressing them like this, you know, where it's kind of for your amusement rather than theirs. I feel like this would be more appropriate if you had, like, twin babies or you know, where they don't really understand what Halloween is.
Yeah.
So it feels like it adds an extra layer, like a Schadenfreude layer to my eyes.
So we know when they're like 16, 17 and they read this caption says, I hope I don't lose one. They might be quite upset with mom.
Yeah.
All right. What else you got for us?
This one you had tagged from Gregory Archibald Hio. Friend of the show, one-time co-host. Mm-hmm. That Mac number one of two. Oh, I guess he has two Macs. So Mac number one of two is going to Catalina. Rest in peace, QuickTime Player 7.
Yeah, I got confused by this because I was a huge user of QuickTime Player 7 forever. It was like my go-to tool for any sort of media. And then it was replaced. It's been replaced by QuickTime Player Pro. But you know, it's back in the days when you had to pay Apple for a Pro license fee or whatever. I used to pay them for that or Player 7 all the time. So I'm still sad to see it go because it was always sort of like a utility belt, you know, piece. I could always rely on QuickTime Player Pro 7, Player 7 to do something for me that, you know, other QuickTimes wouldn't do. But yeah, too bad. I guess it's a 64-bit thing, right?
Yeah. I remember it used to be able to convert formats better than the versions, I think it was.
Better export tools and things like that, I think, right? And cutting and pasting and editing QuickTime videos where you could grab a middle and you could, you know, copy and move it around. It was before they added that trim thing that they added in the Pro version. Right. So he's got another one there, Jaime?
Another one from Mr. Hio. Apparently, he must have been coming to the same realization about the tool chain and shaking his fist mightily at the radio,
phone,
I'm sure.
Yes.
Says, Swift tool chains, download them from swift.org/download/releases or #releases. And once installed, they show up in Xcode preferences. And he has a very good screenshot showing exactly where that would show up.
Yeah, but I thought there was something under the Xcode menu where you could switch back and forth between it. You know, have to try it out.
Well, that's the developer tools, I think.
In that area, right? But I recall, I don't know what version of Xcode it was, but I do recall having, like, you could go under the menu there. Of course, Greg can yell at his phone when he listens to this episode and correct me, of course, he's welcome to, that, you know, you could go over there and choose which tool chain you wanted to load up. But it's been a while since I've even seen that or heard of it. But yep, cool beans. All right, so we'll dig into our follow-up. So I've got the first one here. We talked, I think Chris Wagner had posted a wish that Apple would come out with, a series of hardware and software and services bundles, whether it would be like one price to buy everything and, you know, you pay like so much per year and you get all the tools as they come out whenever you need them kind of thing. I believe that was his wish. But this is, I guess, based on something that Tim Cook had said in the earnings call last week, that he doesn't rule out the possibility of bundling hardware and services in the future. I mean, as case in point is Apple TV Plus, right?
True, which I think students, if you have Apple Music, you get Apple TV Plus for free, and you go to some Apple website to confirm that yes, you are in fact a university student. Maybe high school would work too. I'm not sure. It certainly hit with the educational, you know, system sort of person.
Yeah, and anybody who buys a piece of Apple gear now, since the iPhone 11 series came out, whether you buy an Apple TV or an iPad or an iPhone or even an iPod Touch or a Mac, you get a free year trial of Apple TV Plus services. So yeah, and we'll talk about Apple TV Plus in a bit as well. All right, what do you got for us, Jaime? This follow-up for last week.
Yeah, we had mentioned at the time that the rumor was that Google was going to purchase Fitbit, and in fact they did, for $2.1 billion, with a B.
Right.
Yeah.
And that, I think that came out just after we finished publishing, right? Or the next day, I guess, right?
Yeah, it was rumored before, and now it's, as of this point, official. They're acquiring... a lot of folks are thinking that it's for the data and not for any sort of product stuff. So we'll see what ends up happening here.
So is this like the confirmation that they're going to buy it? Or is this doesn't it have to go through checks and balances before the deal can get approved?
Yeah, it probably ends up going through the Department of Justice, I think, that does that in the United States. Mm-hmm. And presumably some equivalent in other countries and the European Union.
There. Yeah, but yeah, they're just checking for monopolies and things like that. But I can't imagine in this case, because Google is a software company, that them buying this would be anything that would get held up. It's also it's a relatively small company as far as Google is concerned, although $2 billion is a lot of money. I have to believe what you just said, Jaime, that it's gotta be about the data, because I can't believe really that they'd spend $2 billion on just a hardware company. I mean, I don't even know.
No, I mean Fitbit's like been around forever and they're sort of the de facto.
But what's the revenue?
Well it's gotta be on the data, I was going to say, because that's what, you know, people have been exercising with Fitbits for years, right? And, you know, it's one of the first wearables that was out there, right?
Yeah, I want to see what the revenue is, actually. I have no idea. I'm looking this up right now.
Yeah, $2.1 billion in the modern era is really not that much money. And I know that sounds silly for those of you out there listening, but, you know, like Instagram was purchased for like $1 billion cash or maybe all stock. I can't remember what that was. And that was considered a lot, but it's like pennies now.
Well, you're right, but hardware companies tend to have lower valuations in general than software companies do.
True.
Because the margins are much lower. You can make a certain amount of revenue and a lot less of it is profit than for software companies.
So it's less likely that somebody would be buying intellectual property. I guess that is intellectual property data, right?
Like patents and stuff, maybe, not Motorola level, which was like 10 to 12 billion, I think, when they purchased.
Right. I am actually surprised that Fitbit's revenue is as high as it is. It's they're saying it's about, well, what year, when was this, for Q3, which I guess just happened, it was $350 million, which is a lot. That's a lot for a hardware company.
Well, yeah, but they're also the MP3 player of wearables, right? Like they had ubiquity. Yeah,
true
and at a low entry level, right? Low entry cost.
Yeah,
for sure. Well, speaking of government agencies, you know, scrutinizing things, this is via our friend of the show, Fouad, who I think is listening to the show now because I think he's got a longer commute. He's back in the fold. But he had posted that the FCC has now approved the new Mac Pro. This is an article by OWC Mark C, Other World Computing Mark C. And of course, are they a legit reseller in the US? I know they resell Macs and parts and bits and pieces for upgrading older Macs, but I guess you can buy Macs.
I think you can, directly, yes. But,
mm-hmm. Yeah, so they're obviously super excited about the new Mac Pro coming out, which is, I went and looked at the website today. It says available this fall. And isn't fall over in like a couple of weeks?
Well,
right?
This fall probably means fall 2020, which would be right on schedule.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what I mean. Like, yeah, but I mean, don't we have like till the 20th of December or 21st of December when winter starts?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Officially? Yeah. So they're cutting it kind of close. I can't wait to get my big giant dongle, you know? So that was the Mac Pro that was announced then. And I guess people, I guess maybe this FCC approval thing might have been what was the holdup or one of the holdups?
Not sure why the FCC would have to approve this thing.
Yeah. So is this one of the Macs that's being made in the United States these days? Like, didn't they start up something in Texas or Austin?
So I forget what ended up happening with this. I think, so the older trash can style Mac Pro was done in like Austin in Texas, the United States. And then this one was going to be done predominantly in China. And then, you know, trade war between the United States and China went on and Apple applied for exemptions. I think they got partial ones, but I think they're final assembly in Austin, but most of the components still coming out of China is what I think ended up happening. It was very confusing. It went back and forth, so I could be totally wrong on that.
Yeah, we do that with cars here. Like they build Hondas and Toyotas in Ontario at older converted car plants, and that makes them cheaper to bring into the country, I think, right? Because of all the tariffs and things, you know, on foreign made cars. But maybe that's part of the angle behind assembling it, at least in the United States. Who knows? We could Google it, but you know, whatever. This next one, I called it Greg Who, because I was looking up a word the other day and I Googled it and I found out about this website called Etymology Online, or Etymol Online. Etymol Online? Which is basically your you know, go-to etymology website, which of course is not loading for me in Safari. But if it was, I could tell you about it. But yeah, you can look up different words and it'll tell you the roots of them and the history of them, just like, you know, you would do if you were into etymology, as our friend Greg Heo tends to
be. So it tells you everything you ever want to know about bugs,
yes, and spiders, yes. Entomology. It tells you what about entomology if you want to know what that is too, right? Yeah, we were talking about we're making some changes at work, and we were talking about calling dibs, and so I was trying to find out what the origin of the word dibs was. Hmm. So I looked that up on here, and it gave a pretty interesting description.
Do tell.
Well, so yeah, it's a children's word to express a claim on something. I'm reading here from 1915, originally United States, apparently, but it was earlier meant to be a portion of a share or money from the 19th century, but I believe it was earlier than this. Probably a contraction of dibstone, a knuckle bone or jack used in a children's game, or in 1690s. So, in which the first element of is also unknown. But yeah, so if you Google it or look it up on Wikipedia, you'll find that it actually has disputed origins. But yeah, calling dibs is like, you know, like Seinfeld said, he called dibs. What can I say, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's like, yeah, You guys obviously know about calling dibs. I don't know about other parts of the world if they do that, but we do it here in Canada as well.
Yep.
All right. The next piece is a follow-up piece on, we were talking about Apple TV Plus, and we're going to talk about it again. And that is a little note that somebody had discovered and posted in The Verge that says that if you start an Apple TV Plus trial, and you, part of the conditions is you have to opt into the payment, right? So it's like you sign up for a month or whatever it is, and it will auto-renew at the end of that month. If you decide you want to opt out of that auto renewal, it will end your trial period at that time, like immediately. So yeah, if you get into the 1 year trial, certainly don't, you know, wait till it's over or wait till it's near the end before you cancel. So yeah, like people are saying here, set a reminder on now to on your Apple TV Plus October 31st, 2020, if you want to cancel it. But so far it's been pretty pleasant, so I don't know why people would want to cancel unless they run out of shows.
Yeah, if you watch all the shows then.
Yeah, well, there's an angle to that Apple's cooked up. So we're going to talk about the Apple TV Plus Apple TV Plus service in our main part of the show. So I'll save that for later for you folks. So yeah, just a word of advice. It's our PSA for today. Don't cancel until you're ready. All right, Jaime, I see you're hovering over your app, your game club link there.
Yeah, we talked about Game Club last episode, or maybe two episodes ago, the competitor to Apple Arcade, where you pay $4.99 a month and you get access to this series of games that had once been on the App Store and hadn't been kept up, and we were speculating, like, oh, did they buy the IP? Did they get a cut? How did they, you know, fund the, you know, dusting off and cleaning the cobwebs and giving them baths sort of thing to all of these games? We don't know the answer to that, I don't think, because I haven't seen that. But the other thing we were wondering is, oh, so these games are actually in the App Store, and they all have this $4.99 Game Club in-app purchase experience that you can see. And we were wondering, huh, like, how functional does this game have to be? And it turns out, not at all. So Mage Gauntlet was one that I tried out. And when I say tried, I was able to watch the intro animatic. And then after that, I got this little beautiful little advertisement for, like, hey, Game Club, it's only $4.99 a month. Try it out. And an option to say, I already own this game, and I do not. So when I clicked that, the App Store receipt check failed. So I couldn't get in and actually try any of that game. And I tried out Super Quick Hook to see if it was, like, unique to Mage Gauntlet. And it's not. As far as I can tell, all of these games, pretty much within the first 10 seconds of launching the app, need you to have that subscription. So really not sure how that jives with App Store review, but apparently Apple thought it was okay.
That's the kind of thing that used to get rejected pretty much outright. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, but mind you, though, the arcade apps are like that too. Like, I tried arcade for a couple of weeks myself, and I still have the apps on my iPad, and I have canceled the subscription. And as soon as I open the app, same experience. You open the app, and it, you know, flashes the arcade, you know, buy it now kind of message, right? And that's all you get for you don't even get like a demo to try out, right?
Right, but of course, Apple can do whatever they want. Doesn't mean they're going to let somebody else do the same thing.
Well, by the same token, though, yeah, that's true. They do have that sort of, they do own the store, but sounds like it's a similar kind of situation where it requires this subscription for you to use, right? It's not uncommon for apps to require like a login, or I've seen other apps apps, like, you know, business apps on the main store that are useless without a login.
Right.
And
no one was ever saying that this was technically challenging at all. Not at all whatsoever. Very easy to do that kind of thing. It was always, how do they get Apple to allow it?
Yeah, I don't know.
That's still the question.
It feels like the philosophical difference here is before, when it was, you know, straight up purchase this game with the in-app purchase, it seemed like they felt like, oh yeah, you should have, you know, some reasonable amount of functionality rather than like trying to trick people into getting it for free and then like, aha, surprise, you can't actually do anything, purchase this game. And this is being treated more as a subscription akin to like Netflix. Like, you don't get, you know, 10 minutes free of Netflix content. So it's more of a members only club. And I guess that's the philosophical difference that Apple is using to treat this with. It's the only way I can reconcile it in my head.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because it gives new life to new apps.
Or we'll find out in a couple of months that they get kicked off the app store as soon as Apple notices that they're doing this.
Well, it's funny. Didn't you just post something about Electron? Apps with Electron can't get approved in the app store anymore?
Yeah. Spoilers for one of the main topics. So we'll talk about that. But yes, it's still developing there.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute, I guess. Anyway, and you can talk about this next lead here, because I'll probably just do a review of this next product when we get to my picks, but go ahead.
Yeah, this is, you know, follow-up from when we said, hey, Adobe said that real, legit Photoshop is coming to the iPad, and it's here now. It's available.
That was at WWDC, wasn't it? Was it last year or this year?
I thought it was last year, because I remember being at the keynote where they talked about that, I think.
Yeah, I met one of the breakpoints has just joined Adobe to go and work on this product as well at this year's WWDC.
Oh, right.
In Seattle, actually, surprisingly. There you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
It doesn't say much in the article here about the product, right?
It's not so reviewy. It does do like a cursory overview. It's kind of what you'd expect. And obviously, you're going to give your review. The thing I wanted to mention that folks seem to get a little hung up on is, what did Adobe mean by real? And from everything that I understand, what they meant by real was, this is not a separate product that like has the Photoshop name just sort of like, you know, with a sticker slapped on the side. I think they went through the effort to rewrite or refactor, rebuild, whatever they did to like actual real Photoshop to get it to run in this environment. But that doesn't mean that it will be one-to-one parity in terms of functionality, at least not from day one, right? Like, I'm sure they had to go through a lot of effort to get it to even run the way they wanted it to on iPad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, definitely the iPads have the horsepower to sort of compete with, you know, a mediocre Mac running Photoshop. Photoshop's always been a memory hog and all that kind of stuff back in the day when we had limited hard drive space and limited RAM. Now that we've got tons of RAM and tons of space, and everything on an iPad is flash memory, right? So it's all pretty quick stuff. It makes perfect sense. And it does say here that they're using the paradigm of working in Photoshop to make it similar, but because the iPad is such a different environment, it does kind of embrace those features of that you get on an iPad that you don't get on a Mac, right? You're not going to be able to do your 3D stuff. You're not going to be able to do movies and, well, maybe I shouldn't say that, you know, like, because, you know, I use my Photoshop to do animated GIFs. I do 3D objects in it. I've made movies in Photoshop, all kinds of stuff over the years, because it's become the Swiss Army knife of, hey, let's put in the kitchen sink. And the next thing you know, you're doing the dishes in Photoshop, right? That's kind of how it's evolved over the time that I've used. I've been using it since like 1990 when it first came out. So I've seen all the different variations of things in Adobe, in Photoshop. And some of the tools that I was specifically looking for, and like I said, I'll talk about it later, but the things I was looking for, they delivered. So that's a good thing.
I'm hoping that Adobe will come out with the engineering side of this. Like, I can only imagine that some brave set of engineers had to go in with, you know, machetes and chainsaws and go carve out that old carbon code to go get this to run on iPad, is how I'm imagining it. I don't know if that's the real
web views. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was originally written by John Knoll, right? As well. Like, it started out as a real 68K Mac app, right? So it was rewritten for Intel when Adobe was giving up on the Mac back in the 90s, you know? It's been through a whole lot of changes over its time. So, yeah, interesting. But it's interesting that the thing about Adobe Adobe's apps, and I have a ton of Adobe apps on my iPad. And even before I got into the back into the Creative Cloud, you know, I was still humping along with my old, you know, CS6 license. They brought out a lot of apps for the iPhone and the iPad that you could use, and they were also meant to be work with Creative Cloud for cloud storage and stuff like that. And you could move files from, you know, say an Adobe Draw, let's call it. It's not called Adobe Illustrator, but Adobe Draw on iPad. You could move it into the cloud and then open it up in Photoshop and continue, right? So they had that going for them. And but so now that it's come along, it is not a free product, right? That's one of the questions we were wondering about that. Like the other apps I've talked about, Adobe Draw, Adobe Illustrator, there's like there's a ton of tools. There's a Cooler, K-U-L-E-R, color tool that you can get. All of those things were kind of free on the iPad, but this is now a paid app. I don't know if you can buy it specifically by itself. I think you have to have a Creative Cloud account, but the cheapest way to get that is kind of how I got into it. About six months ago, I bought a Seagate hard drive, and it came with a trial of what they call their photography plan, and that includes Lightroom and Photoshop. I've never even installed Lightroom, to be honest with you, but yeah, for getting Photoshop for $9.99 a month, it's a steal in my opinion. And the fact that, you know, like on day one, I was able to open up Photoshop on my iPad and use it right away without, you know, having to jump through hurdles. It automatically recognized my Creative Cloud account, and I was up and running in no time. So yeah, it's pretty decent offering. Now, I've been looking for this product, this type of editing, for a long time. I mean, I do have the other Photoshop Express and all the other, they're kind of like Instagram on steroids, you know, but nothing really like that matches what we have on the desktop until this product came out. That's my 2 cents. All right. So this is another link here from iMore. Randy Ritchie posted today, and I was kind of looking through it, scanning through it, really. That Apple has revamped their privacy website, and they're as he says here, raising the stakes on data privacy. I don't know if you guys had a glance through this at all. But yeah, talking more about how they're, you know, saving us from ourselves, you know, by protecting our data and our use and stuff like that. And the new rules that have come in with Catalina and iOS 13, you know, about how people are doing things with your data. And so Apple, you know, is adding services in to protect us from, like I said, from ourselves primarily. We talked about the signing with Apple stuff that they've added, and, you know, which kind of protects you, and using Bluetooth and Wi-Fi sharing, that kind of stuff. Those new alerts we're seeing in iOS 13, you know, where apparently the reason why the apps are warning people about Bluetooth is because the Bluetooth is being used to track your location or store your location, I guess. And that was something that we hadn't seen until iOS 13 came out, right? In beta.
Yeah, I've been seeing it an annoying number of times with different apps. I'm like, what the heck? Why do you need Bluetooth? Yeah. But you don't.
Yeah, I mentioned in one of my apps, Pi Day Countdown, it pops up and says that Bluetooth is enabled. And I, as a developer, I'm like, what? I didn't even know that, right? And it turns out it's because I've got the ad mob stuff from Firebase in there, right? That, you know, for the ads, that it's doing some sort of geolocation kind of stuff. And why it needs to use Bluetooth for that, is beyond me. I thought Bluetooth was a low distance network, right? Like, doesn't go beyond.
I guess they would give you the Walmart ad if they noticed that you were in a Target.
Oh.
You know, assuming it's Target that's like, you know, in like an urban environment where there's many other stores near it, not, you know, just use GPS because this is out in the suburbs surrounded by parking lot.
Yeah.
Well, or they push a special deal. You know, if you're in Target, they'll send you a coupon for 10% off or something and get you to buy stuff based on where you are.
But the reality is, by the time you get over to Walmart, those two things that they had in stock are no longer there, and you end up buying the more expensive item that's next to it. Oops, did I say that out loud? Insider secret. So that's data privacy. So yeah, if you want to find out more about that, you can obviously check out Rene's article on it, or head over to the Apple website and check it out. Check out the new site for sure. All right. And this is a link I just saw just before the show started. Remember we talked about, I think maybe a year ago or more, about an Uber car that killed a woman crossing the street.
The autonomous vehicle,
right?
Uber.
The self-driving vehicle. Yeah, because we've been talking about the Apple car coming out that I'm just going to get with 16 gig in white, right? The couple of tweets here I saw, that one was in response to the main tweet. Twitter again. Hang on, sorry. I go to Chrome. Copy link. Switch to Chrome. Paste link. Hit return. Yeah, so the first tweet, this was in response to this, is that apparently Uber Uber's radar detected this lady, Elaine Hertzberg, was crossing the street, but she was crossing, she was jaywalking. She wasn't at an intersection. And for some reason, it recognized her 6 seconds before it hit her. And yet, I guess because of the programming, it wasn't designed to make decisions, I'm doing air quotes, decisions based on people jaywalking. So, and of course, the person who replied here, History of Tech on Twitter, said six seconds is enough time to swerve, slow down, or even stop. So she's claiming that Uber intentionally broke safety features that were already in place in the vehicle.
Well, I think that, again, the second claim is a stretch. I mean, certainly six seconds is enough time to swerve, slow down, or even stop. But to say that Uber intentionally broke the safety features already in place in the vehicle is a stretch. We don't know the whole story.
But this is the trolley car question that they wrestle with in autonomous vehicles, right? You know that story? You're familiar with the trolley car question?
Oh, do you?
The philosophical discussion?
Yeah.
But I suspect it wasn't even that. I suspect it wasn't even that they made some decision
I don't think they made a decision.
Yeah, no. I mean it's the philosophical argument would say that they made a decision that killing one person is preferable to some other outcome that would have been worse. Right. Yeah. And I really, really don't think that happened here. I just think that the technology, having worked in a company where we did a lot of detecting of objects and things like that, the technology, the detection is very, very good these days and very, very powerful, but it's not perfect. And sometimes the technology, could know. I mean, just read what it says. Uber's radar detected Elaine Hertzberg nearly six seconds before she was fatally struck. But, quote, the system design did not include a consideration for jaywalking pedestrians, so it didn't react as if she were a person. Well, that's pretty vague. So when you say that the radar detected her, and don't get me wrong, I'm not defending any of this. This is a tragic thing. But I'm just saying, I suspect that there was certainly nothing malicious going on. Who knows, right? But I don't think there's anything malicious going on. And I don't think there was any kind of, I suspect that there wasn't any kind of value judgment going on. It's just the technology just wasn't quite as good at some particular, corner case, which is probably what this was. It was a very unfortunate thing. I mean, I'm not saying Uber I'm not saying that Uber should not be held accountable because if they're going to take that kind of risk, they have to pay the consequences if they have a mistake like this. But I think it was a mistake or insufficient testing or just not good enough technology, which caused this rather than any kind of, malicious or intentional act.
So this is actually in response to, I just dug into the tweet a bit deeper. It's in response to an article from November 5th, talking from Washington Post. Don't know anything about that particular institution, whether it's reliable or not, but they give more detail on the case, it was a Volvo XC90 with sensors, blah, blah, blah. It was 10 o'clock at night, a lot of factors that could have been there, but it does say in the article that, the local Arizona prosecutor determined in March 2019, there is no basis for criminal liability for the Uber Corporation stemming from the crash.
And now I'm looking at the article and they're saying the article does claim that Uber actively blocked the Volvo from slamming on the brakes in an emergency, which, that's a little worse or a lot worse.
NTSB, who's that?
National Transportation Safety Board.
Oh, Safety Board. Okay.
Yeah, they're the ones who typically investigate plane crashes, but I guess they would do this kind of thing too.
Any transportation. So planes are the ones that usually happen. If there's a large enough, or in this case, notable enough vehicular automobile crash, they'll do that. It'd probably be more in like the 20 car pileup scenario if you would see them, and trains being the other big one. They probably do boats as well, but I'm not certain.
Yeah, it does actually say that documents, this is according to the article, documents released Tuesday by the NTSB show Uber's self-driving system was programmed using faulty assumptions about how some road users might behave. So there you go. It wasn't intentionally. They didn't intentionally say
it's just oversight. Yeah, for sure.
But they, people do this all the time. You make a certain assumption, you go with it, and things seem to work. And you don't know that these.
Like the stove is hot, and you don't learn it's hot until you put your hand on it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to parse a lot of this apart because the no consideration for jaywalking pedestrians seems like it almost certainly has to be incorrect as a statement, because I don't understand how you wouldn't have that as part of your model.
Yeah, what about like a fox or dog or something, right?
I'm unclear as to why this object is moving and it is going to intersect with us, isn't, regardless of what it is. Who cares if it's, obviously we care in terms of like human life, but I mean, in terms of what should the vehicle do? Is like there's a moose or a tree or a swarm of bees. Like there's something that's intersecting us. Maybe we should just stop regardless of what it is.
Well, that may be true. But what I suspect actually is going on, and what they mean here with these quotes about never classified her as a pedestrian, is they have some kind of an image classifier where the image classifier classifies this thing in its field of vision as a car or a bird or a person or something, and they didn't have a quote jaywalking pedestrian classification, and that's what they're kind of latching onto in this report, I think. Now
it says the system was unable to correctly predict the path of detected object.
Yeah,
so whether it was a dog or a boulder or a moose,
right?
You know, it was unable to detect.
So,
it was going to
so this and this right? is the problem with machine learning and neural networks in general. It's only as good as the data that that's trained it, and the predictability of the model, the predictive capability of the model. So they probably did train it on an enormous amount of things, and the model just wasn't able to classify this thing as jaywalking pedestrian. So it couldn't react the way I'm sure they programmed it to react in a certain way if it was a pedestrian in the crosswalk. That would be crazy not to. And you know, it's an obvious thing that you're supposed to do, that you'd have to do for this kind of thing. But if the neural network doesn't predict this thing to be a pedestrian, then it doesn't know what to do. And I suspect that's what's happening, and that the translation doesn't, that's the technical description of what's going on. You know, the translation into a legal document doesn't really give the full flavor of what's going on. But the way I'm reading the words is I think that's what's happening, is that essentially the neural network couldn't predict this thing was the type of thing that it needs to get away to take the certain action to avoid. Again, I'm not saying it's a good thing, and I'm not saying that Uber shouldn't be held accountable for having a crappy neural network, and maybe they should.
Right.
But this is how I'm reading it. Yeah.
So this just in, I saw this earlier today, and I didn't follow up on it, but apparently a driverless Tesla was seen coasting in a mall parking lot, raising questions and causing confusions in Vancouver today, or yesterday, in Richmond, BC, which is, well, if you know Richmond, it's not a great place to be trying this stuff out. The other Canadians in Vancouver will know what I mean. But apparently, on Global News, they're reporting that the Tesla was driving on the wrong side of the road for one question. And so interesting I was going to say, like, are in Arizona, are they allowed to drive self-driving cars around? Like, is that cool? Like, I know they're testing in some in California, right?
Don't know. But reading further down in the article, sorry to interrupt you, but I'm reading the article and I'm seeing more and more as it comes down. So, quote, the system vacillated on whether to classify Hertzberg as a vehicle, a bike, or, quote, an other. So, quote, the system was unable to correctly predict the path of the detected object, bumping down a little bit further. In one particularly problematic assumption, given the chaos that is common on public roads, the system assumed that objects categorized as, quote, other would stay where they were in that static location. And there's the problem. So the neural network did not have a classification for pedestrian moving across the street, and it didn't know what to classify it as. So it got lumped into some catch-all other category. And the fail was that other objects don't move. That's a pretty big fail from that point of view. But again, it's just a bad neural network.
Yeah. I mean, even just, thinking about your own sort of personal driving, I've had to avoid this object has fallen off the back of a truck, and I have to sort of predict where it's going to go. It could be bumpers I've had to avoid. I've had to avoid boxes, and I've had to think about what to do. Wait, what's that moving across? Is it a bag, like a plastic bag? Okay, I'm pretty sure it is. I'm just going to go through it. I can't swerve to avoid this just because of highway traffic. But these are considerations like an experienced driver would have to consider. I wouldn't just say like, oh yeah, that's cool. That thing's just going to stay still, because it's not, right? And it's hard to, even for human beings, if it's going to stay still. You have to think about it.
Right. And if you think about what the computer is doing, it's capturing a frame as a still image, analyzing what's in that image and saying, oh, here's a thing and here's another thing. And if it says thing equals car, then it has some, it calls some function that says, you know, swerve. If thing equals bicycle, swerve different way. Else, print, quote.
Run it over, man.
Else, yeah. Log, quote, unknown object found.
Yeah.
Right. And put it to the, send it to the analytics.
Yeah. I mean, if all else, it should have just, you know, it should have had a graceful fallback and just stopped, right?
Right.
At the end of the day,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's interesting, too. If you click on this link that I posted here about this BC self-driving car, you can watch this car driving, and there's pedestrians all around, and it's just, it's stopping and starting and stopping and starting. Like, it's kind of, it must be one of those summons things, I guess, because you can summon your Tesla with your phone, right? But it must have been what it was, because clearly there's nobody in the car, but yet it's driving through this roadway, and clearly on the wrong side of the road at first, but it does correct itself. But I noticed that, like, you know, when you're walking through a parking lot and there's pedestrians, you know, when you're driving through a parking lot and there's pedestrians, you stop and you wait for the, you give the pedestrians the right of way kind of thing. And the car does seem to be doing that. So interesting stuff. Timely. Thanks Tesla for giving us a perfect example to talk about. All right. So Jaime, which jump over to, we talked about this already, the Electron.
Yeah. So this is still sort of ongoing. More details. This came out from David.dev that he was unable to submit an Electron 6 or 7 app to the App Store, to the Mac store specifically. And Electron, remember, is the cross-platform sort of web technology-based set of technologies that allows folks to create apps like Slack or Visual Studio Code or Atom, or probably a bunch of apps that you would think of that are available for Windows and mobile and macOS. Unfortunately, and I think this goes way, way back to the root of the early days of this podcast, you don't necessarily know what your dependencies are doing. And in this case, it turns out that some versions of Electron, and this is the confusing part since I'm not an Electron developer, linked against non-public frameworks like CA Context, CA Layer Host, NS Next Name Frame, you know, calling particular API calls that are private on there. And so this developer was like, hey, what's up? Why did App Store Review, you know, reject this? And it's like, well, because you're linking against private frameworks. It's like, but I'm not. It's like, well, but your dependency is.
You are, yeah.
Right? Like, you have given up that that responsibility to the dependency in this case. So it's tricky. Apparently, looking at another blog post that he has, the resolution that came from Apple was like to use what's essentially a really, really old version of Electron that doesn't do that.
Oh, really?
But it seems like the more reasonable thing is that the Electron devs are currently working on fixes that will not link to the aforementioned private APIs.
And yet somebody must have done it at some point in the past, right?
Yeah, the I don't think it's covered here. The scuttlebutt I saw on the web was that the Electron folks do it for performance reasons, so tapping into things that Apple itself uses under the covers. And that sounds like a perfectly reasonable explanation, but when it comes to App Store Review for, you know, the Mac App Store, that wouldn't be allowable. So I'm guessing this will have a App Store versus non-App Store sort of flavor, you know, like a build setting or something. So continue to use Electron. And if you're offering the app through your own distribution, you probably will leave it turned on, right? So you can get the performance and take the performance penalty, but yet still be allowed on the App Store with the do not link to private APIs, is what I would guess is going to happen.
It's interesting that it seems like, I don't know what the current version of Electron is, but it's been at least two versions, 6 and 7, according to the article, that this has been going on. So it's sort of surprising that this is the first we're hearing about it. You would think someone like Slack would be using the latest and greatest, but maybe not.
Yeah, considering how large their app is, I bet they might not be. They might be a little bit behind for stability reasons with their, you know, hundreds of, maybe even thousands of developers. And you never really know, right? Because it's not like this is, forget even rule of law, it's not like this is some, you know, law of nature. This is more like, look, not saying they do this, not saying they should do this from an ethical standpoint, but if Apple was like, should we pull the plug on Slack? Maybe not. Would we go call them and be like, yo, by the end of this year, you have to get this changed. versus random Joe Bob or Joe Sally on the street, they're going to probably pull the plug on you real quick, right? Because the impact is a lot lower.
Are you saying the other app store?
Going way back to in history. Could be that. It could even be just like Apple's tooling that does these sorts of checks. As far as I can tell from my own personal experience, it seems to be a little erratic or noisy.
Yeah.
I think I mentioned before, like I got dinged for stuff. And was like, what? No way. There's no way. We didn't even change any dependencies. There's no way this could be different. Mm-hmm. And ask them to, hey, can you re-review? And like, oh, okay, cool.
I think there's a lot of manual process in Apple's vetting of apps, because like you said, like you can have one, you can pass through with flying colors one review, and then the next one you get caught for something unusual, right? I've even seen cases where somebody uses, you know, self-documenting code, as Mark and I like to call it, to call something reasonable, you know, in a method name, and then years later Apple rejects your app because they've also called something with a similar name in a private framework, even though your method does something completely different, you know, and you have to go in and rename your method, right, to get it passed. But I think there's a lot of human element in the checking that goes on with apps, right? I don't know that it's an automated process, or can it be, right?
So you think it's like somebody grepping through the files and like, aha, create account, that's a private API.
These are binaries. Wouldn't they have to decompile them to be able to grep through stuff? I mean, they can read strings, but they can't, you know.
The symbol tables are all available. I mean, and
are they?
You know, where do you get your DSIMs from, right? You can get them from Xcode, or you download them from Apple because you compiled the bitcode. So they know, you know, they know the names of everything.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, because I remember the Mr. Shoemaker was telling us about, you know, how people would put in methods like, you know, not Cupertino as the method name and to block
right.
Apple from seeing things that they were doing in the app, right? Yeah, interesting stuff.
Yeah, another possibility of this, I mean, this would be kind of weird, but I guess it's possible. If they have a big enough list of things they want to test, and they've calculated how long it takes to run all the tests and how many apps they have to run all the tests on, and it's prohibitive, right? Maybe, you know, maybe the difference from going to a 10-day review cycle to a one-day review cycle means that they can't spend that much time on everything. And even automated tests take time to run. Maybe it's they just kind of randomly pick 10% of the tests to run or something like that.
Yeah.
And they vary them every single time. It's random so that they figure, well, if we don't catch you this time, maybe we'll catch you next time, or for sure we'll catch you the time after that.
Well, I mean, we all complained about how slow the reviewing process was, and so Apple stepped up their game. I don't know if they added more people or they just sort of averaged out the vetting process,
yeah,
you know, to make this randomized call or lottery kind of call. But because we're now getting apps through in a day, where it used to be a week, if you remember.
Oh yeah,
right?
A day is very standard now.
Yeah, so, or even hours. Like I've seen apps go through in like 20 minutes, literally, yep, personally, yep, right?
You know, but those are pretty rare, but it does happen.
Yep. Yeah, and then you get ones where they're stuck for three or four. I think James Thompson tweeted last year that he had an app stuck in review for at least a week, if not longer.
Here's a PSA tip for anyone out there. If you're doing any kind of MDM app, so using a managed or mobile device management app with Apple, they have now added a new paperwork requirement. So when you submit your app, even if it's been approved with MDM before, when you submit your app now, there's some paperwork you have to fill out explaining what MDM profiles and what MDM commands your app is doing, or your MDM vendor is doing. For anyone who doesn't know what the way managed devices work is, you have a vendor who a company, if they want to only push out apps enroll apps for your company or limit access to certain apps or limit the number of apps or whatever, you can contract with a third party company that's connected to Apple, and there's a bunch of them out there. I don't want to give any free advertising, but there's a bunch of them out there, and there's a managed device set of frameworks with Apple that lets the vendor push commands to the phone, kind of in a similar way to the way push notifications work, where the vendor can push a command saying, hey, manage this app, you know, set this configuration for this app, or remove access to this other app, or something like that. And of course, the user has to opt in and all that, but it's all managed. But anyway, so all that. So if you're using that kind of solution, and they're reasonably common now. Apple has had this new added this new requirement where you have to fill out this online form, submit it, and it can take weeks to get this thing approved.
Really?
So you're doing this on any kind of time schedule, plan way ahead. Okay, that's my PSA for the week.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think I've talked about this on the show before because I was at a demo with Apple in Toronto, and they were showing some of the new things, some of the new hooks you can make in your app. Like you said, can change the configuration of the app on the fly using the MDM tool, right? You know, like whether it's this server or that server or whatever, and changes, you know, you can change the UI based on what you feed it. It's interesting. I do work on a couple of MDM apps myself, and that's going to be an interesting thing when we cross that bridge.
Yeah, if you do have an existing app, I would get on that right now, actually.
Yeah,
get it. Yeah, get the paperwork in place.
All right, I'll have to give one of my friends a heads up.
Yeah.
Alrighty. So what's next, Tommy?
Yeah, you touched briefly on this one. So Microsoft's Chromium-based Edge browser is coming out on January 15th. So to recap quickly on that one, so Microsoft Edge is Microsoft's next-generation browser, the replacement for Internet Explorer. It had its own rendering engine, but Microsoft sort of saw the way the wind was blowing and said, you know what? Chrome is pretty much the standard for the web.
Oh, interesting. And
so they're rebuilding based on Chromium, which is the open source version of the Chrome browser, sort of the basis for it, if you think about that. So they're coming out with Chromium based Edge, which Mary Jo Foley from Windows Weekly has called CREG, CREDGE, or I've seen folks on the internet try to go with Edgium. I think I personally prefer CREG myself. So if you, like Tim, are having issues with Safari, you don't want to do Chrome, maybe you'll try out Chromium, right, or Edge, I should say.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah, I might have to give this a whirl. I don't expect it'll be super different from Chrome's experience, but I kind of wonder, just since I have such the sort of Google ecosystem sort of linkage, I wonder if it will make sense. Like, I'm not super into like the Microsoft ecosystem, which, now that I say that, maybe this will make more sense for me to start using at work, because, you know, like a lot of large corporations, we have pretty big Microsoft stuff. You know, we're using Office 365 and other stuff. So like, being logged in, you know, as my sort of work self through Edge might make sense. Whereas at home, I'm more logged in as my sort of Google account self.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, I don't have any control over this at the institution that I work at, but they a while back had established that Chrome was the default browser for most things, and very rarely do you get sent over to Explorer, or Exploder, as I like to call it. But so this will be an interesting twist on things too. I think the IT departments out there might embrace this pretty well, because they already have established that Chrome browser is Google Chrome is a pretty reliable, stable browser compared to the variations of Outlook we've had, or Outlook, no, what it's called, Explorer, that we've had over the years, right? So interesting story. And this is coming out January? Is it for
January?
Mac as well?
January 15th is the launch.
It'll be a Mac browser, do you think? Or
I don't see why not? There we go. The article says, release candidate build includes sync support for password history, favorites, and settings across Windows, macOS, iOS, and Android.
Oh, interesting.
And includes Microsoft's new built-in tracking protection. So there's, you know, a lot of nice things here, especially if you're going to go sort of cross-platform and be, you know, I think the biggest thing would be having your tabs or your history and other things show up.
Yeah, seamlessly if I could sync those, that'd be great, because I have a real trouble with that when I switch from Windows to Mac and back, right?
Yeah.
Where are my bookmarks?
Sort of a non-issue if you stay just on, you know, Apple's platform, but once you go outside of it to like have an Android device or have a Windows device, it's like it gets kind of messy. And you could go to the Google route, which is sort of the route that I've gone, sort of just based off my own sort of personal accounts that I have. But if I was more sort of in the Microsoft ecosystem, I could see it would totally make sense there.
Interesting. All right, and the next big news, I mean, well, it's not so big news, but
yeah, it kind of depends on what's going on in your app life. But I got this notification, this news and update from developer.apple.com, and says, by the way, the Apple push notification service is going to switch to the HTTP2 based provider API as of November 2020. So this is your notice that 1 year from now, you're not going to be able to use the legacy binary protocol. So you're going to have to use the new hotness that uses JSON web tokens and stuff. So if you don't know for sure that you're on the right stuff for this, you probably should start bugging your infrastructure and backend folks to take a look.
Before yeah. So
you...
is this, if I understand this correctly, so I did go into the thing, because I do run my own APNS server here, but are you basically saying that it has to be HTTPS 2, like TLS 2, 1.2 to be approved, or is there a new sort of standard having coming down the pipe?
So I think you might be asking about the HTTP 2 based provider API. I would have to read docs to see, but what I think is happening here. So there was the old APNS, the Apple Push Notification Service API they had, the like weird binary protocol based one. And then one or two WWDCs ago, they said, hey, we've got this like much better, more RESTful style that authenticates with like JSON web tokens instead of whatever in the world it used before. I'd have to take a look. I think if a lot of folks are using things like, I don't know, Urban Airship or Firebase and stuff for this, you may not have to worry about it because I'm pretty sure those have already switched over. But if you're running your own APNS connection stuff, you're going to have to double check to see what your backend is doing. So that
Firebase
is one
push notifications?
Yeah, that'll handle the or Firebase Cloud Messaging, FCM, I think is what they rebranded Google Cloud Messaging, GCM too. So that'll handle that. But if you're, again, if you're doing like the raw sort of server to server side of doing things, and there's reasons you would do that, you'll need to switch over to that new API. So the other part of your question that I think you're asking is the HTTP 2, right? HTTP/2. So that the new hotness that is, as far as I understand, backwards compatible with HTTP 1.1, but adds several cool things like request multiplexing. So for example, if you have like a web page that has, you know, some JavaScript, some CSS, and then like an image in old school HTTP, those would be three different TCP connections, right? Like, hey, I need this. Oh, by the way, I need that. And then finally, I need this. This is smart enough to say, yo, I have these three things that I want. Please give them all to me in the same request, right? There's header compression. It switches to a binary protocol where compatibility is available. It switches to a binary protocol for all of its commands. If you've ever looked to see, you know, get www.apple.com, you know, accepts this encoding, expects this response. It also has something that I didn't know about, which is called server push, where the server, rather than being sort of reactive to you saying like, oh, I need this file, and now I'm going to need this file, the server can say, you know what? I know that you are, you know, looking at our product detail page, and you're probably going to need all of the assets for our checkout screen. So we're just going to go ahead and send those to your browser now, and speed things up that way. This is not my area of expertise when it comes to the, you know, how these protocols work, but that's my sort of layman's understanding of HTTP 1.1 versus 2.
Your plain speak version. All right. Well, acceptable. We'll accept that for now. So we're now at the part where we're talking about Apple TV Plus. So I have enrolled in a trial. I'm curious to see whether you guys have started looking at it at all, or what do you think?
I haven't used it.
I've not enrolled in it because I know I'll get a free year and I'm looking to buy a laptop.
So you wait until then?
It's that, or if I break down and buy an iPhone 11 Pro
or whatever. Yeah.
And I don't think you get the free year with even a fancy pants watch because you can't watch it on your watch.
Right. I get you. Yeah.
So
what about you, bummer. Mark?
I have not used it.
You've not. Okay. Well, I have used it. And so it's interesting because I kind of wondered, you know, when this 1 month trial thing, how Apple is going to stop me from binging all the episodes. So I watched the morning show. I watched this For All Mankind. And I just before the show, we were delayed starting this today. So I watched the first episode of C so I could, you know, give Jaime sort of a spoiler free impressions. They only serve up three episodes of the series. So I'm not sure if they're going to come out weekly or what the deal is, but they're doling them out. And so it's interesting. I mean, I could talk about the shows a little bit if you like, but one thing we talked a few weeks ago about, you know, wanting a service that would sort of meld all my services together. Well, on the same TV box, on my Apple TV 4K, I keep my brand name straight, on the 4K Apple TV, I have Prime and I have my YouTube subscription and I have my Crave and my Apple TV Plus service, right? And so when I go into the TV app on the device, it lets me choose between the three services as if I'm looking at a regular TV guide kind of thing, right? Not related to the product TV guide. But yeah, so like I can see the new Jack Ryan stuff where I could watch the morning show. Like it's just a matter of clicking on the appropriate icon and it'll launch the appropriate app that will play that content for me, right? So it is sort of a one-stop shop. flop in that sense. You know, we were kind of wondering why somebody couldn't figure that out, right? Because on my TV itself, I have, you know, Netflix and I have these other services, but I have to launch an app specifically to go into those ones there, right? And one of my biggest complaints about Prime is that it's awkward to go into this other app, which I never really open, and I don't really like the interface. And yet here I have access to my Prime content right from the Apple TV app. So that's nice. Anything else you want to hear about?
Did you end up seeing all of these different shows? So you've linked in the show notes this tweet about the Rotten Tomatoes critics versus audience scores for the different shows or the major shows that debuted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so I just went, oh, crap, it's Twitter again. Jesus. Hang on.
Copy January link. 15th can't come fast enough, folks.
Copy link, switch to Chrome, paste link. I should just open the doc over here.
Tim, here's a tip. Put it in private window mode and then try it again.
What, Twitter?
Oh, that might not work for Twitter because you have to log in. I do that for ESPN where you don't have to log in and it fixes the hanging loading problem for at least for ESPN.
Yeah. Well, that's
an interesting aside. Like, I did accidentally fix a problem with what website was I looking at? It wasn't like a paywalled website, but like the normal website wasn't working for reasons. And I accidentally tapped the reader view and it just showed me instantaneously everything I needed to see, which was really surprising. I was like, oh, I guess it has all the text. It's all the other cruft that it hasn't loaded yet.
Yeah, it's weird. I was originally brought to this tweet, and this is what I've linked here from Darkmoor Dave Mark. He had talked, he's been commenting on the shows. And yeah, so it's interesting, this critics versus audience scores on Rotten Tomatoes. The critics are panning the shows and the audience are loving the shows, right? So I have watched The Morning Show and I haven't watched Dickinsonian, but I've watched For All Mankind. Here's my problem with For All Mankind. Obviously, because I'm a space nut, I've watched every possible bit of footage there's ever been about the Apollo moon project, right? And Gemini and Mercury and all that kind of stuff, right? So I have, you guys know it's an alternate take on the actual history, right? You know that part of the story, do you?
Nope. Yeah, kind of Man in the High Castle style of alternate history.
Yeah, it's an alternate, or Quentin Tarantino kind of Inglorious Bastards kind of thing. Well, I don't think I'm giving it too much away if I say that the first footage of the man on the moon is actually a Russian cosmonaut. Do you guys know that part?
I believe the premise of the show is that the Russians had won the race, space race, right?
So immediately, here's my problem with this, right? I watched this footage when I was 9 years old or 8 years old, and I've seen it 1,000 times, you know, the Neil Armstrong coming down the thing, and it was on TV, and they used to, like, superimpose text over top of the video feed, and the video feed says live from the moon in English, and it's a Russian transmission. Why wouldn't it say live from the moon in Russian or Krelik or whatever it is? That's my first problem, and that's, like, within the first 10 minutes of the show, right? You know? It is an interesting show. Once you get into it, you start to feel empathy for the characters, and there's a fictitious astronaut, actually, who's the main character of the show. But it's similar to the, I don't know if you've ever seen the Astronaut Wives Club or any shows like that, or The Right Stuff, or even the Apollo Neil Armstrong First Man movie that came out last year with Ryan Gosling. Very similar kind of look and take and that kind of stuff. Implausible in some places, but then if you're a pure historian, then yeah, it kind of makes you cringe a little bit. But other people I know who are just as space nutty as I am are on Twitters and socials saying they love the show. So who am I to know, right? Or who am I to say? It is an enjoyable show. I am enjoying it. It is very much of its time in terms of how it's portraying things. So that's interesting.
We just had an earthquake, by the way.
Did you? Yep.
Wow. Tiny one.
Oh, wow.
Tiny one. Mm. Welcome to California.
Yeah, yeah. I had one in Vancouver when I first moved out there. I got an earthquake out there. Yeah. I don't think I've been in California when you guys had an earthquake.
We get them all the time.
Or maybe tremors.
We get little ones all the time. Yeah. This one was a pretty small one.
Yeah, The Morning Show is interesting. It's very sort of like, what was that, Studio 50 or Studio 30 show with Matthew Perry or even 30 Rock. It's very similar to that kind of story take. I've not seen it in the newsroom, so I can't compare it to that. But it's very much, you know, broadcast television and all the sort of tropes that you see in that kind of thing. Not going to give too much away. I think most of it's in the trailers. It's an interesting show. It's got great cast, right? So it's very difficult for it to not to be, you know, seen as an audience favorite, right? So it is like, it's got a lot of tropes in it, so it is pretty typical, and I can see why the critics would sort of not give it a great marks, but it's interesting too. Yeah. And then I just watched C, like I said, just before the show. Again, a lot of implausibility in that one. on a lot, you have to suspend a lot of disbelief in that to sort of get the premise and see how it would actually survive, how these people would survive. But yeah, it's an interesting show. And again, more tropes, but a different take on a sort of dystopian future world, right? It's pretty good. Good cast as well. So far, I'm enjoying the shows. I haven't watched the Snoopy one yet, which I guess will be the real test, right?
Yeah, I think the thing that'll be interesting about the Snoopy one is, so remember when, we probably talked about this on the show, but remember when the rumors are coming out, presumably from people who were sort of burned by working with Apple, that, Apple was, Mickey Mousing everything and trying to make it super family friendly. From everything that people have said, these are not family friendly shows.
They're not safe for work. Yeah.
I'm like, somebody described a scene from C, I think, like the opening scene. I was like, oh, really? So did they just go right into it, huh? Okay. So I kind of wonder if the Snoopy one is like subtly gritty in some way, because now it's quite the opposite. Now I'm like, maybe nothing is family friendly, even the Snoopy.
Coming back to my 4-year old granddaughter, like I mentioned before, I've only seen probably two shows that seem to be kid friendly, right? I haven't tuned them in yet, but yeah, there's not, again, when you got five shows, two of them being kid friendly is pretty good, I guess, right? There isn't a lot of content. I do see it having value for the money, right? The $5.99 or whatever it is, Canadian, or $4.99 US. It's not a painful amount of money to pay for the kind of quality we're seeing right away, right? So I think it still needs to sort of find its way, right, in terms of where it goes. But again, it's Apple. I mean, you're going to get good quality stuff from Apple. I just hope it doesn't end up being like that. What was that social network they had on iTunes a while ago? Ping or something like that? What was it called?
Ping. Right. Ping.
Mm. Yeah. I just hope it doesn't go the way of that, because that was interesting at first, but they kind of didn't really go anywhere, right? But yeah, I think they're putting a lot of effort into this. And like I said, they've got good producers and good. I mean, they're backed by Sony on some of the products, right? So it's good quality, movie quality television, if you want to call it that, right? So far, it's enjoyable. Doesn't suck. All right. What's that?
This one you kind of covered a bit from the Rene Ritchie article about sort of privacy in general at Apple, but we'll have this link to apple.com/privacy, where they being Apple, have put their privacy info in a really sort of nice, like as if it was an actual product, like an iPhone or an iPod Pro. Mm-hmm. They've got it up there, and it's kind of in more or less plain English.
Well, this is new. I think this came around WWDC, didn't it, this site? Or is this new?
I think this page may not be new in terms of the URL, but the styling, as if it was like an apple.com/ iPod or iPhone, Apple TV style. Like it's really fancy pants. I mean, they've got cool animations. It sort of explains, like, look at all these cool things of, like, photos protects your images from unwanted exposure, and messages are only seen by who you send them to.
Yeah, I think this is actually follow-up. I think we did talk about this before. I'll have to go through the notes and see. Yeah, but it is pretty cool. I think that,
I think if nothing else, it's inspirational, right? Like, there's nothing more, it sort of brings you down when, like, somebody's privacy page is this enormous wall of legalese. This one's a lot friendlier and helps you understand, like, what's going on.
Can't spell privacy. I guess you're right. It's the only time I see it linked on the notes. Interesting. All right. But it is a very similar style that they've used on other things and lately, right? Anywho, brings us to the picks part of our show. What do you got for us, Jaime?
Yeah, mine is...
Or should I ask Mark first? Mark, do you have a pick?
No, I don't have a pick.
Okay. So you can carry on, Jaime. Sorry. Okay.
Thank you for asking.
Huh?
Thank you for asking.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
Yeah, so mine is, again, it feels like almost like a negative pick like last week, but it's not really a negative pick. I think it's kind of cool. So apparently some researchers have figured out that they can hack into some of these virtual assistants, specifically the devices that you would have at home, like the Google Home, the Amazon Echo, presumably the HomePod. I think that's what they mean by Siri when they say Siri here. So they just point a laser at the microphone, and through physical means that are unclear to me, they somehow get it to think that it is hearing sound.
Really?
Yeah. Maybe I should have watched this video. I didn't have time to see that and see what it is. It must be some sort of weird interference effect or concussive effect for what they're doing, but they can do it from pretty far away. So It seems like the, you know, if you're going to have these devices in your home, if you're like me, the key thing to do is to not have them anywhere near a window. Hmm. So,
are they talking about passing audio signals through a laser beam? Is that what they're talking about?
I think so. And I'm kind of struggling here and hoping that Mark maybe can fill in of like, oh yeah, well, clearly there's like a piezoelectric effect happening or some other similar kind of thing.
Yeah, some hokum.
Yeah, I'm looking at the article. So it's using a MEMS, which is basically just a tiny, tiny little mechanical structure. So you can imagine that this, using the same technology that you use to make, say, a chip, well, use that to etch a little lever, and that thing can vibrate a tiny, tiny little bit, and move a little bit, and in doing so, you know, it changes like the capacitance between the edge of the tip and some cathode or something. And by doing that, you can measure things like acceleration, because say you drop this thing, well, one end of the lever will move because it's in free fall, and that'll change the distance between the end of the lever and the plate, metal plate, and you'll get it, the capacitance will change. So you can use that to measure acceleration. That's how they do things like measure, you know, to protect against when you drop your phone or something like that. It's or detect when you drop your phone or something like that. And all of the sensors in your phone that detect things like gravity, that's all done with that. So presumably what's happening is these things, since they can vibrate at really, really high frequencies, somehow these lasers are coupling into that. It's hard to believe that it's just a mechanical effect. So it's very interesting. I'm not sure what's causing it. In fact, the article says no one knows precisely why, which is kind of interesting. I'll have to look into it some more.
Hmm. Yeah, we'll have to sit and watch the videos maybe.
Yeah, I saw the part where they showed the little animation, and I still don't understand like how, you know, these photons here were interacting in some way with the diaphragm on the microphone to like push it enough for it. Like I could imagine in my mind, I'm like, okay, if you imagine things like solar sails, right? Like you'd have spaceships that like they just, yeah, use the one of Newton's laws.
Yeah, I mean, so light is essentially a bunch of photons, mm-hmm, which have energy and momentum. They don't have mass, but they do have momentum. So whenever you have something that has momentum, you bounce it off of something. You impact. It's like, remember from high school physics, when you take a ball, you throw it against a wall, the ball bounces back with the same momentum that you hit the wall with, but in the opposite direction, right, which means its momentum changed by twice the original momentum. So that momentum has to be impacted to the wall. So the wall is actually pushed a little bit, although walls are usually so sturdy that you barely notice that happened. And the same thing happens with a light sail, like you said. I mean, you know, you have just sunlight is shooting out all these photons, and you have this enormous sail, and it gets accelerated by it. However, it's an incredibly, incredibly small effect, the light sail effect. So basically, a light sail would only work way out in space where there's absolutely no atmosphere to cause, you know, air friction or anything like that. And you'd need a super enormous sail to get any kind of motion out of that, because the effect is so small. So it's sort of hard to believe that a laser could do that, even to a tiny little thing like a MEMS device. But something's happening.
Should we take a minute and watch this How Do Light Commands Work video for science?
Yeah, I don't know if they go deeper in. Like, I see examples of how of it working, and a sort of hand-wavy animation of like, oh, mm-hmm, laser hits the diaphragm. I'm like, yeah, that's cool. That doesn't sound like it would, to my mind, like that doesn't sound like it would be enough to move it. To Mark's point about like the solar sail thing, like it'd have to be massive, and it'd be it just doesn't seem like enough change to be like, oh yeah, that seems like the same amount of movement you would get from sound waves moving through at normal speaking volume. Like, I could sort of imagine if these microphones were of the quality to be like, oh, it's really good at listening to dog whistles, right? Something super high pitched, you know, well out of the,
yeah, but if that were the case, range, then you'd pick up some hiss or something every time you turn the light on, right, in your house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, they're saying here that apparently the lasers influence the microphone diaphragm somehow by you know, the energy moving the diaphragm. So they must be able to send a signal through the laser, which the laser somehow. Weird.
Yeah. I thought it was cool because I was like, well, heck, like, one, I don't 100% understand how this can move it enough. And not only like, oh, cool, we proved it could move the diaphragms. Like, hey, we can actually, you know, control it enough to encode a command. Mm-hmm. You know, like as if I told it to, you know, open the doors or turn off the lights.
Yeah. I'm really interested in now.
Scary stuff. The future is scary, as one of my favorite podcasts likes to say.
Future is scary.
The future is scary. All right. Speaking of scary futures, my pick here is actually not that scary. I've been playing around with Swift UI, as I've been saying, for many, many months now, and they keep changing the language. Darn it. You know, surprise, surprise. But I found this website here called Swift UI Cheat Sheet, and it's got pretty much every command you might think you want to use inside, and plus links to other resources. Like if you're looking to set up a text field, which is what I was trying to do, like text field obviously is it creates a field just like you normally would have. You can have a placeholder value. But one thing that kind of caught me by surprise was, and shouldn't caught me by surprise, is you have to create a state variable first for the text field to become equivalent to, and then use that as your value inside your field. And you can do text field or secure field, which is like a password field, to create a text field on the screen. And I've been also, as a side note, I've also been enjoying Paul Hudson's Hacking with Swift videos that he's been posting for the last, you know, couple of weeks on his website, on his YouTube channel. And yeah, they're pretty quick, you know, 5 minute long example lessons on how to do various things. Like this last week or last couple of days, he's been covering drawing on the in your apps, you know, drawing using arcs and circles and shapes insettable shapes that different protocols that work inside of Swift UI. So that's kind of cool. So anyway, my pick this week for the Swift UI folks is this Swift UI cheat sheet. And notice it's only been updated 5 months ago, so I wonder if it really is up to date. I would think that since it's a GitHub page, they would keep it up to date, right? Wouldn't you?
I see commits as of October 30th.
Okay, so it is updated. Okay.
When I look into the list of commits.
Yeah, I just like there's definitely the folder. Yeah.
Jumps. It was like June, August, a couple times in August, and then nothing until October. So maybe somebody's tracking the releases or something.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, cool. All right. So before I get to my next pick, I think Mark might have a pick. Mark?
I think I would. Why?
Or you found this Light Commands PDF.
Yeah, oh, this is the original article
that
I found, but I haven't actually read it yet.
All right.
But sure, that can be my pick if you want.
All right. Cool. Looks very technical.
Yeah.
Very scientific. All right. Cool. All
right. There might actually be some math. Oh, there is some math in it. Equation one. One equation. All right.
So my last pick, of course, is Photoshop on the iPad. Surprise! Yeah, like I said, the minute I heard about this on coming to the iPad, I was excited. And in a minute I saw it was available on the store, I went and downloaded it. And again, I was even more surprised and delighted that I didn't have to pay for it because I already had a Creative Cloud subscription to the photography plan for $9.99. Yeah, so it has, and what's really good about it is when you first launch it, it takes you to 6 videos that they put together, really high quality videos on how to use various features. So the challenge, I've been working with graphic designers my whole career on computers, and I gotta say, no offense to my friends who are graphic designers out there, but you deserve this. They are the fussiest people who use computers in the world. You move one menu command or change one tool, and they do nothing but complain about it. So it's not your mother's Photoshop. Let's put it that way. But yeah, it is pretty cool. Launches pretty quick. You can work with any kind of Photoshop. If you have a Photoshop file in existence on your Mac already, you can really quickly and easily import it into Photoshop, and it has all the same sort of things as you would expect. So for instance, I was actually surprised. I had found a PSD file that I used to do some of our, like, I mean, you know, the one with the space field and I have Snoopy and the cow or the TARDIS floating around. I use that for the show artwork every now and then. So I have this one big giant file, which has got all the variations of TARDIS or Tammy or Doctor Who or Snoopy and the floating cow in there. And of course a laser lens flare effect, which I don't know if I could do a lens flare effect in Photoshop on the iPad, but I went to share it from my Mac. And it went in on when it came over to the iPad by AirDrop, it went into Photos, and I went, oh, that's odd, because I was thinking that it was just making it into, you know, a flattened file. And yet when I went to Photoshop on the iPad and I opened it up, it does recognize it as a PSD file. And so I have all of my working layers here, and you know, so when you're working in layers is a huge thing in Photoshop. This is how we organize our work, and we do channel layers and channel masks and stuff like that. All of those kind of things are built into this version of Photoshop. And and other Photoshop-y kind of things that Adobe has put out in the past don't quite have this level of quality. This is very similar to what you would do on the Mac itself, right? The toolbar on the left-hand side where you'd expect it to be, you've got your typical stuff like you've got your selection tools, oval, square, and anytime it's like or lasso tools, you got those as well. Of course, it works great with a pencil, which is lovely because I've been using AstroPad on my iPad to be able to use my pencil to work on my Mac in Photoshop, and now I can do directly on the iPad itself. But you know, so when you go to select a tool, you can long press on the tool and you can choose between ellipsis or a rectangular selection. Lasso tool has got their magic wand selections in the quick selection, the magic wand tool are there. There's a type tool as well. I haven't really dug into that one too much. Cropping, of course, you know, whenever I do the episode for the show, I have to make a square crop for the podcatcher, like Outlook or Overcast. But I also do have to make a header version for the website. So I've got that. You know, erasing and brushing. And of course, you've got layer masks, as I mentioned before. You can edit directly on the mask. You very quickly turn on and off layers and work with. And layers have all the same sort of effects and modes that they have on the Mac. So you can have like a normal and you can adjust the opacity of a layer. You can have it, you know, do dodge, color burning, screen effect, which is where, you know, highlights show through, darken the color, lighten the color. So all the sort of visual effects you'd want to do in Photoshop for the most part are available to you. So like I said, I opened up this file, which I've been, you know, working on for the last, you know, 3-4 years. And all of the layers that I've worked on over the year are in there. There's one of Tammy here. There's one of like Snoopy, as I said before, the Doctor Who composite, the Red Cup. I think this one started with the Mac Pro floating in space, if I remember correctly. Yeah, even right down to my original basis for which I made the Starfield as well, right? So yeah, I'm really enjoying this. I'm looking forward to using this tool on a regular basis because, like I said, I use Photoshop all the time on my Mac, and now I plan to use it on my iPad. And the only thing is missing. Can you guys guess what the only thing is missing for me in this whole new adventure?
No, I don't know.
Come on. No interface builder and no Xcode editor.
Within Photoshop?
Well, if they can put Photoshop on my iPad, why can't they put Xcode on my iPad?
I see. So it was the iPad in general, not Photoshop. Yeah, I got it.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, I would, you know, I could pretty much abandon my Macs if I could do, because I could edit the podcast on an iPad too. It would be cramped. Actually, I have more free space on my iPad than I do on my Macs, right? But, you know, I could edit the show on the iPad. I could do the artwork on the iPad. If I could only do coding on the iPad, it would be good. Well, I guess I shouldn't say that because you can do that Swift Playgrounds thing, right? Which I think I talked about. Because you can do Swift UI and Swift in the Playgrounds as well. Yeah. So. And it's cool because, like I said, you know, I can work on this file here and then I could just move it up to the Creative Cloud and then I can pick it up on any one of my Macs that has Photoshop loaded up on it. So it's pretty cool. They've kind of got this sort of ecosystem working where, similar to how iCloud works, you know, when you're working in Apple apps and other apps that use iCloud, you can work on your iPad or your mobile iOS devices and then save the files into the cloud and then pick them up again on the Mac and that kind of stuff. Like I do that with Pages and, you know, various tools like that. So yeah, this is really, really well built program. I haven't really sort of played around with it for too much time to sort of get any sort of, you know, oh, it's super buggy at this and super buggy at that. But yeah, just, I'm just delighted that I've got access to this, right? Well, here's my Rick and Morty layers. You like double click on things to see the, like you can grouping layers and that kind of stuff, which is something that's very important to do, and give the layers names, and, you know, so you can add, like you can put a bunch of images together in a group and then move them around on as one unit kind of thing. So yeah, it's pretty cool. All the things that I would want to see in Photoshop, I've got layer properties and so on and so forth. Yeah. And you can look at the layers in either this new iPad kind of style, or you can look at them in the traditional Adobe style where you've got the looks like nested folders, right? Yeah, pretty cool. Happy, happy, joy, joy.
It seems pretty neat how they've tied it into their PSD cloud files. They gave it like a new extension, I think. Mm-hmm. So I think that's pretty neat that they're doing it more. I'm assuming it's more Google Docs-y in that way. Like, I don't know if you can collaborate with other people the same way, but certainly at least between your devices, it should sync, right?
Yeah. Well, they have this Adobe Bridge thing, which they introduced around, I want to say Illustrator 5 era, like a long time ago, where you have this sort of like a finder for images and artwork. They've had that for a while, and they've sort of incorporated that into the Creative Cloud too. So I think that's part of the magic behind it. But it definitely has a cloud icon here. And the other thing too is like there's no save dialog box on the iPad, right? Whereas, you know, when you're working on the Mac, you constantly have to remember to save things. And it just, you know, as soon as you make an edit, just like any other iPad app, it automatically saves it for you. That's cool. Here, I'll take a screenshot of it so you guys can see what I'm talking about. It's Slack built with Electron. Is Slack still built with Electron? Do we know?
Slack, I believe, is.
What the heck is Slack?
And that's the one that folks tend to think of as like their memory hog. But I will counter with VS Code, Visual Studio Code, is super snappy and fast. So it doesn't seem as though using Electron necessarily makes your app a memory hog.
Wow, my Slack was just freaking out here. Oh, we just got one of those Amber alerts on our phones. Didn't make any noise, though, which is good. Cool. So if you look at the screenshot I just sent you, so you see, this is the traditional Photoshop layers view on the left right-hand side there. You know, like you can see the TARDIS sort of halfway down, and you can see the black with the white outline. That's a layer mask, right? And the eyeball with the eye X through it means that those are layers that are not visible, right? And so the Snoopy one, you can see how it's grouped at the bottom there. The multiple objects make up Snoopy. And then on the right-hand side, there's like the one of the things about the Photoshop is the way the color palette works. You have a foreground color and a background color, and you just tap on that little circle there to change the color. You know, long press on the brush pad to make, and then use a key, like a finger command, like a gesture, to make the brush go up or down. So in Photoshop, you use a lot of keyboard commands. Obviously, you can still, if you have a keyboard hooked up, apparently there are keyboard commands built into this Photoshop as well. I haven't tried it with mine yet. Pretty cool. That's a cool thing. Questions? Concerns? No?
No, it's definitely not my area of expertise, but I just think it's really cool that this level of software exists. And
Pro app. Yeah, for sure.
I think other apps were coming as well, like Illustrator and other ones that they've talked about.
Yeah, that would be cool. Rumor. I haven't tried the Bezier tool out yet, but because that's going to be the real... Oh, is there a Bezier tool here? I don't see it. Oh, one thing's missing, I guess. I use the Bezier tool all the time on the Mac. But that would be really cool because we do have Bezier paths in iOS, right? So it shouldn't be that hard to do it. Maybe that's a future coming up. Yeah. So super, super stoked about this, this version of Photoshop. Go team Adobe. By the way, I think it's the 10th anniversary of the introduction of InDesign. Did you guys hear that the other day?
Really? It's only 10 years old. I feel like it was 20. Older than that for reasons, but 20. I guess not.
Yeah, no, because they were talking about it at the, they had the Adobe Max thing on Monday, the keynote, and they mentioned InDesign. I was actually at the original introduction of InDesign. My wife and I were there at one of the Macworlds or whatever it was. And I think it was a day that one of the two Adobe founders retired. Kestner, I think. Anywho. All right. Well, I guess that's it for another week. So, hey, Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you on the interwebs, where would they find you?
I'm on Twitter as @devwithahair.
All right. Mark, if people want to get in touch with you?
Mark R at smapsoft.com.
All right. And as I say every week, my name is Tim Mitra, TimMitra on the Twitter machine is where you'll find me. And so until next week or next time, we'll say bye-bye.
Bye.
If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fm. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at mtjc_podcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskMTJC. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/mtjc. You can find details on how to help us out on our website at mtjc.fm/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
So you know the exact minute that I found Photoshop or iPad, I rushed over to the notes to make it my pick. And I hadn't noticed that you had put the Verge article there ahead of me. And then I went and checked the versions. It takes like half an hour for the versions to show up in the Google Doc because it's so long. And it turned out you had meet me by like a few hours.
Yeah, I saw the statement in the notes. I was like, I didn't realize Tim had it there. And
yeah,
I appreciate the honesty there.
Yeah, no, when I went back, I'm like, I'm sure I had it there first. And then when I went, because I didn't see your thing about the Verge, right? And then when I went back and replayed the history of the document, you had your pick in there, and the picks were both empty, right? So. Neither one of us had something in there. You know, I'm finding this Photos app on macOS and also iOS even more disappointing than it was in the past, because it used to be really good at keeping up with new pictures you put in, like photos of people. And now I find constantly have to go in and it's like, oh, I can't find any more pictures of that person. Like, there's like five of them sitting right there.
Oh, you know? Wild.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if you use the faces recognition thing in your photos.
I mean, is it possible that's like an iOS 13 thing? Because for whatever reason, Mail will just occasionally decide that it doesn't want to show me new notifications.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other thing I noticed was that Safari View Controller across the entire operating system had gone haywire.
On Mac?
In iOS.
Oh, okay, yeah. I've noticed lately that Safari just kind of stalls when I'm trying to load pages. Like if I try to load Twitter, it just takes forever. I never used to do that.
I've seen that on a couple of websites too, like ESPN.
And you sit there and you look at it and you're like, okay, I'll go open Chrome, do what I need to do, and come back, and Safari still hasn't loaded the page.
Right, and it never will.
Yeah, I wonder if it's a certificate thing or something.
I think it was I read something about it. The fix was to delete some preference files, so something got corrupted.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you were holding it wrong, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, so the Safari View Controller on iOS thing going wild for me. It took me a while to figure out what's happening. It was, I don't know if I was in an RSS reader or if I was in Twitter or something. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you tap on the link and it's like, oh, okay, cool. I want to see this in the full browser. So I tried tapping the little button in the toolbar. I was like, it's not reacting. That's weird. And then I tried tapping on links within the article. I'm like, oh, they're not doing anything. And I thought, oh my gosh, this website is so terrible. It has corrupted this thing. So I, you know, closed out the app, went back in, still didn't work. And then I said, wait, let me go try, you know, other apps I have that would have a Safari View Controller. And it was just hosed for the entire operating system until I rebooted the phone. Something had just caused Safari View Controller to flip out.
Huh. Are you blaming Safari View Controller or the Safari app altogether?
Well, it's unclear. And for all I know, and I didn't test it super rigorously, maybe it was this particular website. I think it was The Verge. I was looking at some of their articles.
Yeah.
I think, you know, because they do weird stuff on their site. And even after using the content blocker stuff, it still seems like stuff leaks through. And so I thought, oh, maybe they were doing some stupid thing that caused the operating system to freak out. And it was exhibiting this weird behavior rather than just sort of like silently killing whatever was going wrong and continuing to, you know, move on with our lives. It was definitely the worst possible experience you could have. Since all I did was basically just click a link.
Was that in an app that you were building or in somebody else's app?
Somebody else's app. And I don't remember if it was an RSS reader app, Feedly, or if it was the Twitter app. Mm-hmm. I can't remember because it was just like in the morning, you know, just looking at stuff while eating breakfast. And I was like, getting very angry at what was going on here.
Right. All right. I'm going to close this photo app because it's annoying. You like our new voiceover guy, Hame?
I heard that one. Who did that end up being? Because I listened at higher speed, so I didn't slow it down to see who.
But did you listen to last week's episode? Because he didn't say who he was on the first one. It's a friend of mine named Mike Vinkamans. He's we had him on Roundabout. His episode hasn't come out yet, but. Yeah, he's a advertising guy who's got this really interesting voice, and so he put a demo tape together, and he's, you know, trying to get work as a voiceover guy. So I said, well, here, read my outro for me, right? So, yeah, so he did the little intro at the beginning there. He was recording some stuff for Spotcast, but let's not get into this show. So, you did listen to last week's episode, right, Jaime?
I did. Okay. That's why I knew that there was somebody different, but I didn't recognize the voice, and now I understand why.
Yeah,
it wasn't just an artifact of listening at 2x speed. It was because I don't know the person.
I like to use Tammy's voice because she sounds very professional for some reason, and now we've got Mike, so that's cool. All right, so yeah, what else is going on?
Anybody interested in a mobile engineering manager job at Coinbase?
Mobile engineering,
they have my money, Coinbase. Those guys, they won't give it back.
Coinbase,
yeah, it was not the
digital currency,
the crypto place.
Well, apply for this job, maybe you can get the money back.
Yeah, Coinbase. Yeah.
Yeah. Get real friendly with the ops folks.
Yeah, because I spoke to... Well, the problem is they don't have any way of getting it back into my hands, right? Because, let's see. Because I remember I bought some last couple of years ago when we first started talking about Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, like, my current money is worth $110.77.
Oh, and why can't you get it out? Did you forget your password or something?
No, they don't have any way to, there's no, the Canadian banks don't recognize them as legit, though. They can't transfer that to a Canadian bank.
They can't just...
So you would need an American bank?
Yeah, or find a Canadian coin, Bitcoin place and just trade it over to there, but...
they can't just send you a check?
I'm pretty sure, I'm trying to remember how much I invested in this thing, because let's see, you used to be able to see on the phone, see if I'm up or down, but I think I'm pretty much broken even right now. Like, I think I put 50, maybe 60 bucks into it, and it's 110 now. It was a lot higher before, because obviously it went really high a while ago. It's come back down. Yeah, it looks like the highest I had was $237.74. So I've lost $120 since it came down.
Oh, you didn't actually lose because you were already ahead, right?
Yeah, I'm a long tail investor, right? So, yeah, how's Apple doing today, actually?
Let's see.
It seemed like the markets were kind of down in general from what I saw.
It was up to almost 240 last week.
Oh, it hit 257. 257 to close that today.
Yeah, 257, yeah. So going up.
Yeah, it was an all-time high today. Wow, how about that?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no. It was at 258.19.
What's the all-time high for Apple?
258.19.
Oh, okay. But it hasn't quite hit that yet?
It hasn't quite hit that. But that was, what was it, last week, maybe?
Well, last week.
I'm going to see when it was.
Yeah, 2760. No, it's just in our my little Apple app here. It just shows 257.60 was the highest it's been.
Google is telling me the 52-week high is 258.19. Maybe it didn't close there.
Looking at the two-year chart, it's the highest it's been.
Yeah. No, it's the highest now that it's ever been.
Yeah, I got back in around 150, 160 or something like that, though. Again, winning. I think Apple, Facebook, and Twitter are my only three that are making money. And there's one weed stock I have, which is going down for some reason. I can't figure out.
Changing. One last question. Random question. Do either of you have experience running, like more modern experience running Windows in any way, shape, or form on macOS or on a Mac? So like Bootcamp comes to mind, VMware Fusion, Parallels.
Yeah, Fusion. I've used Fusion and Parallels in the past. But
yeah? Like how recent past? Because I used Fusion back in like 2010. It was okay.
No, I've used it since then. Like maybe 2-3 years ago.
Yeah. Do you have any recommendations? Like my basic need is occasionally I will need to run Windows stuff like .NET framework. Yeah. I can try Mono, I can try .NET Core, but I kind of want to get close to what our customers are going to tend to use.
Yeah, well, Fusion is
probably that stuff works.
We use VMware Fusion for our VMs at work, like when we're emulating the Macs and stuff like that. Fusion's a pretty solid product, I think. There's also that free one, VirtualBox. That'll also run Windows as well, right? I haven't run Windows 10. I think Windows 98 is probably the last time I ran anything. Maybe Windows 7.
It's the Oracle VM VirtualBox.
Yeah, because that's when you can run Ubuntu or whatever various flavors of Linux on it as well, right? And you can use the same partition you use in. But I find that from a driver's point of view, the VM Fusion is probably the best one. You know, because just trying to get on the network is sometimes tricky with a VM box, right? I wouldn't go Bootcamp. Bootcamp's a pain in the butt.
Yeah, that was my thought. I was like, if I could just run in a little window when I occasionally need to run some Windows stuff, and then obviously I got to get this sorted out with IT of like what do they approve and everything. But
we also use Citrix. Citrix not an option for you for like you can't VM to the office or something like that. Like do you have a Windows home directory like on your Active Directory server?
I don't know. Maybe I don't like the company in general is Windows in Microsoft based, and so yeah. We're kind of the odd ducks.
So do you have like a Windows drive like that you can mount on your that has like the documents and notes and pictures and stuff like that?
We're all using like Office 365.
Yeah.
When it comes to like corporate stuff, as opposed to like my division, which tends to use like Google Docs, Slack and stuff. So it's Teams and Office 365. So I don't know the answer to that. Like I've only done it through the web. I haven't like mounted a drive or anything.
Well, so like if I mount Citrix on, if I go through VPN and I mount the Citrix apps, then basically my Windows environment is right there and I can open Explorer or Chrome or whatever on the in the Windows environment. But on the Mac, because of Citrix, it interfaces just like I'm running an app. It's a bit slower on the VPN, but if I'm in the office, you know, I can do all the Windows kind of stuff. But like since they switched over to Chrome, as I said in the notes, it's pretty seamless for us on the Mac users. And now that we're all on Office 365, it's been pretty seamless that way as well. But yeah, I think if I was looking to run Windows on a machine, I would definitely look at Fusion for sure. You need to have a legit license, right? Like a Windows license, but you know, you can do that. You used to be able to do it with an OEM license. I don't know if that works anymore, but like you get like an OEM installer and then run it. Actually, if you buy VMware Fusion, it usually comes with a Windows license, right?
Oh, interesting. As like a reseller thing?
Yeah, like they package, if you buy it all in the package, it comes with, because VMware Fusion is like $50, but I think Windows is like $100. So if you're paying like $100 or so like that, then, or if you get the company can probably supply it to you, right?
Yeah, I'll definitely like have to provision everything through IT. It was just
like they may have a Windows image that they use to install in their stuff for security reasons and stuff as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. What I don't know before I start asking the questions is, do they have guidance for this scenario?
Yeah.
I kind of have doubts because it's probably not a super common scenario.
Like you want to do
so
what?
That's why I was like, I better ask for some recommendations of like,
yeah.
If they don't have one, I will push them and it's like, hey, why don't you go evaluate this and then figure it out, you know?
I'm pretty sure they're aware of VMware Fusion because they probably use it for other things like VMs that they use in their Windows environment, right? Like on that have multiple servers and stuff like that. It's just a great way to share resources, right? Rather than having to go and configure a giant server with lots of RAM and lots of drive and then only use like a fraction of it, they can make multiple VMs and share the space.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.